So Hugh, you're basically the AI regulation guy for health startups. And there's been this big party going on where lots of health startups are coming out using LLMs like GPT to make lots of interesting products that are going to help patients. And then you walk into the room and sort of clear the room by talking about regulation. So why is it that we can't just let the builders build and worry about all this stuff once they've got something that's production ready that's going to be used with patients?
Okay, let's flip this a little bit and go, a man in his garage invents a new drug that claims can cure cancer and starts having a party. Do you take his drug? No. So why do we trust people who have built a bit of software claiming it can do X, Y, and Z in healthcare with no evidence, no quality assurance, no risk mitigation? We shouldn't. And so regulation is just part of life. Everything we do in medicine has two sides to a coin. You have benefits and you have risks, right? If you operate on someone, the benefit is you can remove a tumor. The risk is they could die. They could get an infection. You could cause other damage. There are benefits and risks in health technology, regardless of what your software does. And the onus is on the person who is building it and developing it to prove that the benefits outweigh the risks. So I'm sorry if, you know, I'm considered a party pooper, but all I am doing when talking about regulation in AI is trying to ensure that that benefit-risk ratio is positive and will actually do what it says safely and effectively. And there's no moral or ethical argument otherwise that could convince me that that is the incorrect way to do it.
So why aren't you trying to regulate Google search like the old school one? People have been Googling their symptoms for decades now and you haven't gone in there. Why LLMs in particular?
Okay, so just to be clear, I don't regulate things. I help people become regulatory compliant according to the law in the country in which they're selling the product. But yeah, so why is Google search not regulated as a medical device? It is protected by other laws, and especially in America, there's specific laws about access to information that cover Google search. The liability of the correctness or the factual accuracy of medical information through Google actually lies in the third parties who are providing that medical information. Google is just an intermediary and is not processing that medical information in any specific way or making any direct diagnosis or informed treatment recommendation to a specific patient based on their condition. They're just responding to a search and giving accurate information as is advertised by third-party suppliers. So Google search is not regulated in that regards. It is still regulated and still is liable for lots of other things, you know, data protection under the EU GDPR, HIPAA compliance as well, cybersecurity, etc. So it is still regulated in other ways and sectors. It's just not a medical device because the intended use of Google search is not to diagnose, treat, monitor, alleviate a specific disease or condition for a specific patient.
This intended use point is very interesting because I remember in the early days of YouTube, you would have random accounts, teenagers, put up copyrighted music videos. And the first 2 seconds would always be in Comic Sans, no copyright infringement intended. And that was like their legal defense against anything. So on a serious note with intended use, I've seen a lot of these tools. One example, I spoke to Martin Shkreli, who was making Dr. Gupta a GPT doctor. And they say very clearly, look, this is just for experimental purposes. Don't use this on actual patients. This isn't a medical device. Is that good enough when you're just putting stuff out there just to, you know, see the vibe and see how it lands? And then later on, you can worry about proper regulation?
Unfortunately not. The regulators are quite clear that your intended use isn't just what you say the device is for or not for. It's actually what the lay person using the device understands it to be usable for. So if you release this stuff on the online saying, you know, it's a doctor because you've used doctor in the title and you can get, you know, a medical opinion, people will use it for that. And so disclaimers have no legal bearing or standing. There's really solid examples in case law. So for instance, there was a beta monitor company who released, you know, one of those video monitors so you could see your baby sleeping in its bed, but it also had a temperature monitor on it. And that was fine. And then people started using it to see if their baby was ill or not. But the intended use was just to measure the temperature, not tell you if the baby was ill. But because people were using it for that, it was a regulated medical device because that was the use that was used as by the lay people. So it's the same thing with all these LLM models that are calling themselves Dr. X or medical this. They can put whatever disclaimer they want. They have no legal standing and they will fall down in a court of law should it ever get that far.
Can you explain why it's more difficult for an LLM to become a medical device or be regulated as such? Are there any particular things inherently about them that make it more difficult?
Yeah, three things come to mind. So the first thing is that you have a problem in regulatory terms known as SOUP, which is Software of Unknown Provenance. And so when you're building a medical device, you have to quality assure your entire software stack, and that includes bits of software that come from third parties. So typically you would have to make sure you're vetted, validated, and approved in terms of cybersecurity and quality assurance, all the components of your medical device. So if you think about a hardware medical device, I don't know, like a hip prosthesis, you would quality assure your suppliers of the metals, you would quality assure the suppliers of who are doing the sterile packaging. So in software, you have to quality assure all of your blocks of code and all the bits and interactive microservices within your software stack. Now, LLMs, especially third-party ones, as supplied by like ChatGPT, they come via an API. So you have no way of quality assuring that LLM as is provided because it gets updated every time. You know, reading through the documentation, it only stays locked for a period of 3 months and then becomes redundant. And so it's constantly changing in the background. So you can't quality assure your third-party provided LLM. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that when you have an intended use as a medical device, you have to be quite specific about what it's intended to do. And the problem with these large language models is they just can do everything. Well, ostensibly, they can do anything in medicine. You could ask it any medical question whatsoever. So it's doing not just diagnosis. It's also offering treatment options. It's also, you know, synthesizing information. You can ask it to analyze something for you and draw a table. So it's covering such a wide range of functions that it's almost practically impossible to clinically validate every single one of those functions. And then the third problem is it's just infinite in its inputs and outputs. So anybody could type anything into a text box and you will get an infinite amount of outputs. And so it's almost impossible to quality assure, statistically powered, that every single output is verifiably accurate, correct, or whatever. So it's almost like the technology is too big to be regulated. It's too vague. It's too unclear. And it's just so difficult to try and imagine how that would all be fitted together within any existing regulatory framework. But that begs the question, are the existing regulatory frameworks fit for the current technology? And the answer is no. But that is just what happens all the time. Regulations exist based on the current best practice or current accepted science. If someone invents a new technology, you have to invent new regulation. And the example I always use is if someone invented a teleportation device where you could walk in one end and arrive in, you know, a different country a split second later, there's no regulation for teleportation devices yet. You have to invent new rules. So the same thing is around large language models. There is no direct regulation applicable to it. We have to try and squeeze a square into a round hole in terms of putting it into the current medical device regulation, which doesn't quite work.
So you're giving a very bleak case for LLMs ever being used as medical devices within healthcare. Do you think there is a path there somehow?
I actually don't think that this technology is best suited to become what's known as a medical device. A medical device is something that is specifically intended to diagnose, treat, alleviate, monitor, predict, cure a disease for an individual patient. And I actually don't think these large language models are really suited to that. I think these are much more suited, because they're generative in nature, much more suited to back-end healthcare operational tasks, synthesizing of patient records and notes, maybe translating a clinical note into lay language or something like that. So I think everyone is trying to apply it to diagnosis or treatment, and I think it's the wrong angle. And a great quote, I was at drinks last night, a great quote from someone that's like, well, just because this system can write poetry doesn't mean it can diagnose cancer, right? They're completely different, fundamentally different things. So we should be using it where its strengths lie, which is language manipulation, which is essentially what these models do, rather than try and use it in, as a factual, accurate system, which demonstrably is not.
If you zoom out and look at yourself in the third person, there's a bit of a principal agent problem where your job is in helping startups get market approval. And there becomes a bit of a problem or a conflict of interest where it suits you to make this into an important topic, talk about how important it is for all startups. Do you know what I mean? And do you think people should kind of trust what you say or take what you say with a pinch of salt because of that?
You don't have to listen to a word I say. I'm just repeating what is written in law. The medical device regulations are enshrined in law. So if I'm not going to tell you to do it, someone else will. So yeah, of course, I run a business. We offer regulatory compliance consulting as well as other things. If you want to use us as your consultants, great. There are hundreds of thousands of other regulatory consultants. We just happen to specialize in AI as a medical device, which is the topic of this conversation. So yeah, all I'm doing is highlighting what the law says. It's like saying to a policeman, don't you have a conflict of interest in highlighting the law to potential criminals? I mean, maybe, but I do it for the better good. Look, like you, I'm a trained doctor, right? I have that innate sense of do the right thing for patients ingrained into me. I'm a scientist. I like to look at things factually. What is the actual evidence? And if I walk into a room and go, well, what's the evidence? And let's do this by the book. And people call me a party pooper. I'm like, well, I'm sticking to my guns. I'm sticking to, you know, what I've been trained to do and how to think about patient safety. And you know, I am in this space because I believe in innovation as well. Like, I've done two health tech startups myself, or worked within two health tech startups myself. I'm really excited about AI in medicine. I've given up my career to be completely 100% devoted to it. I want it to be done properly according to the laws and regulations. So yeah, you don't have to listen to me, but it's written in law. And look, there's the slow way, which is the regulatory way, the regulatory way, the clinical validation, all this kind of stuff. And there's the fast way, which is move fast and kill patients. Which one do you want to do? It's up to you.
That has a good zing to it. So can you paint a picture of, if we let all of these LLM health startups run wild, what do you think, like, what would an actual tangible harm be? Because similarly, people aren't idiots. Like, if they see an online tool and it says, not for medical use, speak to your doctor. If doctors are using these tools, they're probably going to do a sense check. They're aware of some of the issues, like hallucinations and other things. So people aren't idiots. Like, what do you think, like, the actual worst case scenario would be if people like you weren't making the world a better place?
So people aren't idiots. Well, I disagree, actually. If you think about how stupid the average person is, and then you've got to realize that 50% of people are more stupid than that. The average reading age globally across the world is somewhere between ages of 7 and 12. The fact that we have warning labels on McDonald's Hot Pocket saying this is hot, or coffee saying this is hot. Individual people are smart, crowds are stupid. I think that's the quote from Men in Black, at least, something like that. So no, I disagree with the premise of your question. Because we've launched this around the world, anyone can have access to it. Some people may take what it says completely at face value.
Fair enough. Thank you so much, Hugh. I will stop recording. Do you think there's anything else we missed? Or I think that was really good.
That was like the shortest podcast I've ever done.
I know it was quite short, but I think you speak very concisely, and it's very, like, information rich. So I think
ask me something else. What do you want to know about?
I know it was tricky because I think we've done one previously as well. So those are the ones I want to know about. Do you think there's anything else on LLMs as applied to health that's like a important point?
I want to talk about some of the practical stuff as well.
Okay, like what?
Well, like, people think doctors are actually going to use these in clinical practice.
Yeah.
So in order to get the best output from an LLM, you have to type in a prompt, right? And there was an increasing sort of academic or even play sandbox type concept known as prompt engineering, where people are trying to get, you know, the right wording into LLMs to get exactly the right output that they want. So this whole prompt engineering is actually a growing thing, and people are now advertising full-time jobs for prompt engineers. Doctors don't have time for that. They are not going to sit at a desk and come up with really long really, you know, finely tuned prompts to try and tease out some kind of bit of information from an LLM. And you know this, because as a junior adopter, you have written query fracture on a chest X-ray request form. And that's the best prompt you could give to a consultant radiologist was query fracture. So you're not going to go to an LLM and type in this lovely little case vignette, four lines long. 95-year-old Betty fell off a chair and she's taking, you know, misoprostol. And you're not going to write all of this stuff. And I think people who think doctors have the time or the inclination to use LLMs in that way are fundamentally mistaken. And then the other thing I want to talk about is that the only metric that anyone seems to be touting about these large language models in medicine is that they're passing medical exams, which is like completely the wrong test. Completely the wrong test. Okay, you and I know that doctors don't just sit there all day answering three-line vignettes and answering a multiple choice question, A, B, C, D, or E. That's not what doctors do. The art of medicine is elucidating the pertinent historical facts from that patient. It is examining that patient with your hands, your stethoscope, or whatever tool you have. And it is doing diagnostic tests, imaging, blood tests, whatever it might be, physiological tests, and then assimilating all of that information. Once you get all the tests, you are not then going to type a four-line vignette into ChatGPT, or even just give it all that data and ask you to come up with some kind of diagnosis. That's not how medicine works. And then I want to pick up on one of Martin Shkreli's points in your last podcast with him. He said, well, in 15 years, we're not going to have any doctors, which is just completely ridiculous. Because who does he think is actually going to apply the medicine to anybody? I mean, it's not like a patient's going to sit there typing into a ChatGPT or voice recognition into a ChatGPT model. Someone actually has to do the medicine, the physical examination. You know, there has to be a pharmacist to go and hand out the drugs. There has to be a porter to take the patient round to the scanner. There has to be a surgeon to operate. People will still be involved in medicine. So all of this talk about, you know, this is the end of jobs is in my view, completely unrealistic. And I feel quite defensive about this. I'm an ex-radiologist. And, you know, 7 years ago, I think now, Jeffrey Hinton said all radiologists would be out of a job. But there's not a single radiologist who's lost their job to AI. Maybe apart from me, because I left to do AI. But that's about it. It didn't replace me. And anyone who's saying, oh, yeah, we're going to remove all doctors because I've built a large language model is completely deranged and deluded in my view.
Do you have any thoughts on spotting bubbles in health technology? I know that you must have had a few more technologies come past you in your time and either not be successful or be successful. Do you think that LLMs are maybe, again, this kind of bubble that's going to pop eventually? And do you have any thoughts on like good frameworks or good ways to think about things to spot what's a bubble, what's going to pop, and what's actually going to have a big impact?
Well, the standard framework is got this hype cycle. So, you know, something goes up, all the hype, then it comes all the way down, everyone gets disillusioned. Some hardcore enthusiasts keep going, and then there's a slope of enlightenment until you get actually something that is actually useful. So, you know, we're probably not even near the top in terms of large language models of the Gartner's hype cycle. But if we look at, you know, deep learning, image-based classification, that went through a massive hype bubble 2015, 2016, came massively down as people went, it's not very useful. And now it's starting to be deployed where it's been proven to actually work. So I predict exactly the same thing with these large language models. So in essence, any new thing that makes mainstream news media without having been verified, validated, clinically proven, is by definition in that early stage of Gartner's hype cycle. So, yeah, I mean, just like, you know, investing in cryptocurrencies, if you want to get in early before it goes mainstream, yeah, you can make a bit of money, but you will eventually lose it before you get into that trough of disillusionment. And that's where you make the key investments into the people who are doing it properly, will take the regulatory environment seriously, take clinical validation seriously, and then get up that slope of enlightenment to a usable product, which finds product market fit.
I know that for pharmaceuticals, we talk about bench to bedside being, I think it's 17 years, like that's how long it takes. I don't know what that figure is for clinical AI and now upcoming large language models and such, but I imagine it's not far off. And you can disagree with me on that. Do you think that the time taken for a discovery to go from like a DeepMind lab or from a startup and into clinical practice, do you think there are parts of that that can be trimmed or shortened? Do you think there's bits that are unnecessary? And in terms of the, I keep on saying regulatory stuff because I don't actually know a lot or have much of an insight into it, so I'll just call it that. But is that like an appropriate length of time that that takes? And can you give a ballpark of how much time that adds onto something being implemented?
So regulation doesn't add any time into something being implemented if you start it from day one. In fact, you can get to market faster if you start your regulatory journey straight away. What causes the delays is people invent a technology, they spend a few years making it better, and then someone says, well, I need evidence now. So they go out and do a clinical study. And they go, right, now I need regulatory approval. And then they start their regulatory journey. So that's how things get slowed down. I think you could get new health technology to market within 5 years, if you know what you're doing and you understand these processes. It can be much faster than the pharmaceutical drugs because they have to undergo prospective studies. So you get technology regulatory approved, you could do it on a retrospective data set. You don't necessarily have to do it prospectively. So there's, you know, fast track kind of clinical studies that you can do to help with that. So in general, I would say 5 years. I think with deep learning AI systems, since it became popularized in 2014, I think it took 7 years to get the first product sort of purchased in the market. So yeah, it's about that. The other thing that can be sped up is the procurement processes. Very, very difficult to know how to sell a new technology into healthcare systems, especially in America. If there isn't a CPT billing code for a certain function, then no one can buy it. If there is, which you have to lobby for, and that takes time, then yeah, you can get onto market fairly quickly.
The other like slightly simple question I've got is that in terms of these systems, these artificial intelligence systems that are essentially made in a way where they're constantly collating new data every single day and updating themselves, I don't really understand how you can regulate that consistently going forward. Is there a path there when something's changing every single day, minute to minute? Like, do you need thousands of people sat there checking every second, or like, is there a path?
There is a path to some iterative processes within AI software in healthcare. And both the FDA and European regulators are looking at what are known as predetermined change control plans, or PCCPs, and algorithmic change protocols. So basically, you predefine with an external regulatory body that my current algorithm does this function to this level of accuracy. In future, I want to improve that accuracy by ingesting more data and retraining. They say, that's fine. What is your process? Document that process now for how you are going to do that and how you're going to quality assure, clinically validate the improvements. Show us that you've done that, and then we can follow you up. And we'll re-audit you every year to see how those algorithmic change protocols, those predetermined change control plans, have been followed to show incremental improvement over time. I don't think the iteration will ever get as fast as daily. I think, to be fair, if you're updating your software daily in a medical environment, that probably poses way more risks than benefits. In general, people like their medical device to maintain its level of functionality day to day. We don't like change in healthcare. If someone moves a button on a screen, people get very confused very quickly. So I think slow iteration will be possible. Currently, no iteration is possible. You have to release the software and that's it. It's frozen unless you want to reapply. But yeah, slow iteration, maybe every 3 months, who knows, will be possible. But daily, I think, is probably out of the question.
Okay, Hugh, thank you so much. I think that was really good.
All right.